You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today's date is the 9th of February, believe it or not, 2026. And I'm Matthew Raphael Johnson, as always. I ask you, my friends, for your prayers. I have a heart catheterization procedure this Wednesday. I'm hoping that that's pretty much the end of it. I'm not nervous about it at all. I'm exhausted all the time. There's probably a blockage. My father died of a heart attack at 70, you know, so. I ask your prayers sincerely. However, we will not dwell on that. I want to talk about a man who it is conceivable that he may be the next president of Russia. And this is the economist Sergei Glazyev. Glazyev is just 10 years older than me. He is a pro-Russian Ukrainian. He's an economist. He's actually born in Zaporozhye. He received his doctorate in economics from the Moscow State University, just as the country was headed to utter collapse in the early 90s. His best-known work is The Last World War, The U.S. to Attack and Lose. It came out in 2016. So I think it's the only work of his that's been translated into English. He's had about every possible academic and government advisory job you could think of. But most importantly, he was on the board of the Eurasian Economic Commission and was an official advisor to President Putin until 2019. It's important to note that his works are not necessarily about economics as such, but about their ethical and national foundations. Yeah, he drives me crazy. He talks about, he says that Jews who run Ukraine are fascists, and talks about that they're like Nazi Germany and all this other nonsense. I can't take it. But that sort of thing shouldn't lead to the total rejection of everything he says. In fact, a lot of what he says is quite good and interesting, and he has a lot of influence. It's my opinion that Glazyev represents the basic consensus of the Kremlin, the elites in the Kremlin, Russia, Ukraine, the economy, and it really comes out of the old pragmatic Soviet nationalist and anti-Zionist paradigms that came of age in the 70s and 80s. One of my favorite quotes from him is actually from 2023. He said, "The ongoing change of the world system takes place in full accordance with the previously identified patterns of this process. It began with the collapse of the USSR, and today it ends with the collapse of the Pax Americana. In full accordance with the theory to maintain its global hegemony, the ruling elite of the US unleashed a world war, seeking to crush or chaotize," that's my translation of what he writes, "the countries that are not in its control. China, Russia, Iran." Yes, chaotize. That's the best I can do with that word. The man is under personal sanctions from the U.S., so he can't really be that bad, really. But he, as an economist, and it's almost like he's a meta-economist. And he has written a lot in his life. And I've gone through so much material from him, and I've gleaned what I think are the more interesting parts. Hopefully I can put together something coherent. And he begins, you know, at least in my mind, with the concept of the unlimited issuance of dollars, which used to ensure American dominance. Of course, way in excess of the needs of the American market. And it's partially tied up now in the pyramid of the American derivative market, as well as being dumped abroad, which is on 35% of global financial assets. There's a strong correlation between the so-called growth of leading American companies, the big ones, and the Federal Reserve's bailouts, quantitative easing. The Fed is creating the market capitalization of virtually all large domestic companies in this country. So you have the simultaneous increase in dollars, the growth of the derivatives bubble, and their unsecured liabilities, leading one to realize that this is a pyramid scheme, because current liabilities can only be serviced by issuing new ones. Now, I've talked about derivatives on this show and on Daily Nationalist many times, and there are many economists who struggle to define what a derivative really is. But that market right now is estimated at maybe $2 to $3 quadrillion. Let me define what a derivative is. And if something may bring the U.S. down, it's this. We could define it as a security, that is to say, anything that has value. A security whose value depends on or is derived from an underlying asset. The derivative represents a contract between two or more parties. And of course, its price is going to fluctuate according to the value of the asset from which it is derived. Well, that seems very innocent, right? But Warren Buffett said that this was a weapon of financial mass destruction. Didn't start off that way. Used to be a form of insurance for farmers to guarantee the price of their forthcoming crops. Like a futures contract, a miller would pay a fixed price for wheat that they hadn't harvested yet. The miller would assume the risk that the crops would fail or market prices would fall, while the farmer assumed the risk that prices would rise. This is what happens when you live in an oligarchy that utterly controls and nullifies the state. The derivatives market exploded when speculators were allowed to bet on the rise or fall of prices, exchange rates, interest rates, and so-called underlying assets without actually owning them or even being able to deliver the underlying asset. It's kind of like a racetrack. You could bet on a horse without owning the horse. That means there's no limit to the number of bets. So they can hedge their bets by selling short, borrowing and selling stock or other assets that they didn't really own. It was a form of counterfeiting that diluted the value of real stock, but drove down its price, and in many cases, driving the company to bankruptcy. And in that case, the short sellers didn't have to cover or deliver at all, which is called naked shorting. So, the financial system of this unlimited dollar emission, which benefits only, for now, the largest of the American transnational corporations, is starting to fail, and everyone knows this. The American, and with it its global or Jewish, financial system in Israel and the U.S. has become unstable. The real sector, that is to say, the sector that actually makes things, has not just been stagnating, but has collapsed. 20% of investment money actually goes into producing things in the U.S. Living standards have collapsed. Old industrial centers are now slums. Large cities and even states are going bankrupt. Some of which are discussing even introducing their own currency. About 40% of Alaskans are very interested in separating from the U.S. Roughly 30% of Texans do, the last I checked. In fact, there's a petition back in 2014 that was entitled Alaska Back to Russia. It's on the White House website for a while. 14,000 signatures in 3 days. I haven't heard much about it. The Alaskan Independence Party even elected a governor. But this indicates the utter exhaustion of economic development opportunities within the oligarchy. This order that emerged after the after World War II. So what does the regime do? Seeking to stabilize the situation, the regime has to destabilize creditor nations. If Russia could be put into chaos, if China could be brought into chaos, a massive amount of American debt could be written off. You could even start appropriating assets. By creating, I don't know, managed chaos, orchestrating armed conflict in these nations, it's in the financial interest of the regime. All these coalitions and the so-called hybrid warfare, which is a term that Glazyev uses all the time and drives me crazy. But his position is the wars that the Americans start are at least partly about taking the resources, taking security, so to speak, necessary for maintaining its economy in some kind of a functional state. The current economic order, nothing in it, legally or financially, has anything to do with the participation of China, India, or any BRICS or SCO nation. As it turns out, the isolation, or the U.S. and the EU are isolated from the world's fastest growing countries. That means the ruling oligarchy has to attempt to slow the growth of this new center of global economic development. That's a tall order today. India has slowly but surely, and this is a big deal for Glazyev. He's visited the place many times within the in official capacity of the Eurasian Union. And he realizes that India's been very sensitive to coercion by outside forces, especially the Jews within the regime. The U.S. is struggling to delay the collapse of its financial system. And one of the ways it's doing this, according to Glazyev, and he's right, is he's shifting the burden of servicing debts to other countries. Or even writing them off, which is really the core of Donald Trump's tariff policy, which I've always had mixed feelings about because I love tariffs, but I'm not sure in an oligarchical system they make any sense. And of course, we live in a country where there's really no support for the state. But warfare, at least, used to be a way to get nations out of economic depression. But that was a long time ago. the endless military provocations, Ukraine being just one, the escalation of terrorist activity all over the world, the Caucasus and the Volga region. Terrorism has now been normalized. The American colony in Kiev, which is purely Jewish, and the actual terrorists who are struggling to divide Syria like a corpse. As always, I said this before, I'll say it again, there is no government in Syria. There is no government in Libya. Now, the Eurasian Economic Union, it doesn't get talked about very much. It initially was three countries, Belarus, Kazakhstan, and Russia. It was enlarged to Armenia and Kyrgyzstan, and then Armenia in 2013. The market now is roughly 170 million. Moldova has observer status. And Iran, it shouldn't be a shock to anybody, became an observer in 2024. Iranian exports to the Eurasian Union rose by 8% in the following year, while imports from the Union to Iran experienced a 16% increase. So it has been a boon to the Iranian economy. The point of it is to make sanctions irrelevant. See, rather than the financial and non-productive functions of the Western financial world, the priority areas for the Eurasian Union's bank are the power sector, mechanical engineering, chemical sector, mining, oil and gas, infrastructure in general. The bank is a partner in these projects, not a Shylock. Although it bothers me that the bank is an observer at the World Economic Forum. They are a part of the China's Belt and Road movement. They are closely connected with the EAEU, Eurasian Union. And a Sino-Russian strategic partnership has been a reality for a very long time. He seems to think this is fairly new. The media treats it as fairly new. The relationship between Russia and China goes back to Nicholas II. But among all the countries that I've mentioned, who have substantial development plans, major investment projects, and of course the SCO, as a security service, really a security organization, is a part of this as well, which would also make sense to you. Russian high-tech products are entering the Chinese market, as they always have. And Russia is a core of the global economic, the world, the Eastern economic world, and its tremendous growth. Russia hasn't even begun to reach its potential. Sanctions have been completely nullified. Sanctions have been a good thing for the Russian economy. Now, as far as Ukraine is concerned, remember, Glazyev is Ukrainian. I'm going to quote him directly here. And he writes as, on a personal note. He says, "I grew up in Zaporozhye, in which heavy fighting is currently underway to eliminate Ukrainian militias, who have never existed in my small homeland. I attended a Ukrainian school. I'm well-versed in Ukrainian literature and the language, which, from a scientific perspective, is a dialect of Russian. I've never noticed anything Russophobic in Ukrainian culture. In 17 years of living in Zaporozhye, I never encountered a single Banderite follower of Bandera. It was considered an offensive word. You'd use it against someone. Get a punch in the face for it. Never in my wildest dreams would I have thought that we would live to see the current state of fierce fighting between the armed forces of Russia and Ukraine. Now, one corrective here is that he certainly wouldn't have come across a follower of Bandera when he was growing up, since it was illegal. But that's nitpicking. Putin has stated many times that Russians and Ukrainians are one people, however they have different political backgrounds. I strongly urge my listeners to get my 2019 book, Ukrainian Nationalism. And I go into great detail on the question of Bandera's ideology, especially in the context of the post-World War II world. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Americans turned it into a colony to serve its needs. Putin called the collapse of the USSR the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And I agree with him. Not because there's anything wonderful about the USSR, but it dissolved an economy almost overnight, leading to widespread poverty. And I mean poverty. Russia was at the door of the fourth world. At the same time, the propaganda was being put out in Ukraine that Russia is the enemy. They refer to the USSR as Soviet Russia. If you've been listening to me for any length of time, you know how absurd that is. There's another book also called The Ukrainian Catastrophe, which was banned by American censors in Ukraine. I don't think that exists in English, and he says pretty much the same kind of thing. Now, he likes to think in terms of cycles. And he sees we're living in a period of shifting technological and global power. Of course, it's always accompanied by economic crises and major wars. He says the shift began with a dramatic increase in energy prices, after which the economies of the world's leading countries are plunged into a prolonged depression. I don't think that's true. As far as the West is concerned, that's what he's talking about here. It began at least with the collapse of 2008 and then COVID, hollowing out an already pathological American economy. It is a pure oligarchy. Markets do not apply. And there has been no recovery. There is nothing in the structural system, the institutional system in the U.S. that recovery can come from. Now, I've said it 100 times, but as the U.S. sees itself fading, it's going to lash out. It's like an animal being driven into a corner. He also thinks that an arms race that derives from this creates a new wave of growth. But I don't think arms races are sufficient to bring an entire economy out of a depression. He also thinks that during this growth, an opportunity opens up for new leaders, unencumbered by old ideas and old industries. Now, he says that this is culminating in the post-COVID leap of China and India to become leaders in global high tech. Now, that's certainly true. China is the number one economy in the world, quantitatively and qualitatively. Russia is number four. You have to use purchasing power parity, which I've talked about at length. I can't talk about it now. We're talking about things like nano and bioengineering, additive and cognitive technologies, for better or for worse. These technologies themselves are not neutral. and worse for the West, the metals, to build some of these and to power some of these are pretty much only found in China. Now, what's interesting about it, and Glazyev, he won't use the phrase, of course, but he says the breakthrough of the East is going to overtake the West, and certainly that's true. He calls it a convergent system of socioeconomic development, combining centralized strategic planning, market competition, state control over financial and material infrastructure, and private enterprise. That is absolutely true. That is called National Socialism. It is both nationalist and socialist. The state integrates the interests of various social groups around a common goal, the common good of public welfare. This is what economics is all about. The old order is then figuring out ways to provoke as many wars as possible with them. And the phrase hybrid war is used 9 million times by Glazyev. Now, hybrid war, as most of you know, is a war not just with rifles and pistols, but with information, propaganda, the use of psychology. Yeah, that's always been the case, especially in the 20th century, but this is deeper. The regime, the way I use the phrase, has enemies and has generated its own enemies. China and Russia, and sometimes India, sometimes Pakistan, Iran, obviously, whose growth rates are many times higher. They form the core of the new emergent system. The nature of the system is completely alien to, you know, economists don't, you know, National Socialism, yeah, they call them fascists sometimes. That's just name calling. But Western economists still normally just think of everything in mathematical and market terms. They assume globalization is a great thing. And so something like this is beyond them. Simply don't have the mental infrastructure to deal with it. And then therefore they tend to simplify it. They create a caricature. I've read this too many times in professional journals to think anything else. The regime demands Russia be crushed, viewing it almost metaphysically as an adversary. But they do this through the construction, not understanding, of its leadership and policies. Ukraine, therefore, has been a primary target. Right now, Taiwan is not in the front page, but it may be very soon. I don't know what the U.S. has left in case something happens there. I can't get into the so-called military purge. You see the press is going crazy about this, despite the fact that Biden and Obama had far deeper purges of the U.S. military. Turkey, after the so-called coup back in 2016, had a massive purge. Pakistan had one, Colombia had one, Mexico had one, Argentina had one, all from 2006, 2010. But that escapes them, of course. But Ukraine is extremely important to the regime. And they're following the precepts of everything, everyone from Brzezinski to Bismarck, the Austrian and British ruling classes, who culminated in World War I. The point is to tear the Russian world into antagonistic parts with the goal of its final annihilation. But China has benefited from this too. It's a massive mistake from Western leaders. We quote him directly here, talking about the North Atlantic Alliance. Due to the objective laws of changing global economic systems, the U.S. will lose the global hybrid war it has unleashed. In a fit of Russophobia, they've already played their trump card against Russia, the issuance of a global currency. Following the imposition of sanctions against Russia, which seized all Russian assets in dollars, euros, pounds, yen, these currencies automatically lost their status as global reserve currencies. Other countries are faced with an urgent need to create a new monetary and financial system independent of them. Russia could have taken the lead in this process were it not for the dominance of American agents of influence in the banking and financial sector in Russia. That's something that Dugin says quite often as well. If anyone would know, it would be him. So when he thinks about a resistance coalition, he wrote a book called The Last World War about 6 years ago. The basic conception, in order to be a true resistance coalition, the utter refusal to use the dollar as a world currency, the introduction of an embargo on the import of computer equipment and the use of information and communication technologies from countries that refuse to conclude a global convention against cyberterrorism, especially the U.S., introduction of sanctions against countries that violate the International Convention on the Prohibition of the Development of Biological Weapons. It is now clear that this also includes the U.S. Okay, well, the first one is fine. But I don't really care if they sign a piece of paper or not. Ukraine does use chemical weapons against Russia. And they can do this for one reason. For 8 years of occupation by American and British intelligence, public consciousness of the Ukrainian population was reshaped. The younger generations were raised in this Russophobic idea. Americans and NGOs left the Russian leadership no choice but to launch the invasion to prevent the mass extermination of the Russians living in the Donbas. He says, as soon as Russia began to crush Ukraine, Moscow was hit by a prepared information resources and monetary and financial sanctions war. Well, they'd already been there. However, to fight the defeat on the information and cognitive front and significant losses in the monetary and financial front, Russia has significantly strengthened its position domestically. Here he's talking about the influence, first of all, of a fifth column of American agents of influence. And for some reason, I immediately think of Andrei Movchan, the Carnegie Center in Moscow, who was an idiot. But that has been weakened, especially, you know, Putin has been, that's his claim to fame. They were unable to influence the Russian president under threat of confiscation of their foreign assets. There still are a handful of those living in Moscow and Petersburg who are dying to prove their loyalty to Washington and London. However, most of the agents of influence who poisoned the public consciousness in Russia many years ago, they have simply fled. Many of them are in jail where they belong. As a result of the imposed sanctions, secondly, the budget rule, according to which oil and gas revenues from the budget were invested in the obligations of NATO countries, was automatically abolished. Now the hundreds of billions of rubles are at the disposal of the government and can be spent on constructive purposes, while NATO spirals into depression. Sanctions. The enemy has effectively halted capital outflow from Russia. This is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, sanctions have been a good thing. Sanctions are almost a massive tariff. Freed from manipulation by American speculators, the ruble has strengthened significantly. It is a regional reserve currency, whether people like it or not. There's a voluntary withdrawal from Western companies from the Russian market. And as I've said before, it opens huge opportunities for import substitution and for local companies to form. Sanctions have allowed unemployment in Russia to be extremely low. The U.S. has, in this frenzy of anti-Russian sanction mania, starting from Obama, even earlier, the U.S. has exposed itself. It discredited the dollar and undermined the trust in the global monetary and financial system. Of course, the war has shown us the violations of the Convention on Biological Weapons, etc. And I personally think, and he thinks as well, the NATO bloc is fragile. In my book, which you really need to buy, The Foundations of the Russo-Ukrainian War, 2022-2025, I go into great detail of this and issues very close to it. NATO is, to say the least, a paper tiger. Paper tiger would be a compliment. I go through all of the defense ministers, the European countries, and it's hilarious. Most of them are women. They're just politicians. They have no connection or a knowledge or ability or any connection whatsoever with the military life. It shows you how seriously they take their role. A tiny percentage of NATO's forces, I'm talking about the European NATO, of NATO's forces and equipment are combat ready. The Ukrainian war has exposed NATO equipment as awful, overpriced. It's led to the deaths of many Ukrainians, and actually many foreigners, many of those from the countries that produced it, like Sweden and France and Britain. Of course, they can never admit it, but it has led to their deaths as well. Tanks in the German army right now may be a quarter function, and that's being very generous. The sanctions have been nothing but a great thing. You guys remember what happened, and Glazyev reminds us also, the fabrication of all the obviously fake news about war crimes in Ukraine at the beginning of the war. One of the things that came out of the, well, among many other things, but the Epstein filed. Of course, Epstein wanted to overthrow Putin, saw him as a major enemy, which is a great thing. They're exposed for what they are. This is a huge gamble. The regime letting that stuff out is a massive gamble. Yeah, Trump is involved in it somehow. I haven't read all 9,000 pages, but it doesn't matter. The regime is completely exposed, so to speak. On top of that, a massive economic crisis. And Glazyev does talk not in great length, but the migrant problem, which is tearing apart European cities as if they don't have enough problems. The Western world doesn't stand on the brink of catastrophe. It is in catastrophe. And anti-Russian sanctions were the beginning. He says Russia will never withdraw from the liberated territories of the Russian world in Ukraine because it's Russian. Of course, this, you know, he's writing this a few years ago. They're now a part of Russia officially. And because they use the ruble, they have seen a massive amount of investment, not just from Russia proper, but from China and its allies into the area. So has Crimea. They went from fourth world to first world overnight. Well, technically second world, because that's what the Soviet Union was. The second, U.S. is the first world, you know, Soviet Union was second world. They've also learned to never negotiate with the puppets of the Americans. Never fall for offers for a retreat in exchange for unfreezing assets or something like that. It won't happen. It's impressive how fast Russia was able to create an entire alternative resistance economy with the East when the sanctions were first levied under Obama. Now, of course, you have, and this tends to be underestimated even by me, rapid formation of a new system, independent of the U.S., which means independent of liberalism. I've been talking about this for two decades. Now, because he's Ukrainian, he takes the war there quite seriously. And the events prior to the war starting. And he deals with this in the last world war. The war in 2014 actually began because Yanukovych wanted to join the Eurasian Union, not the EU. Now, Johnson's Law being what it is, your average educated person has no idea what it meant for Ukraine to join the EU. The agreement on the association of Ukraine with the EU was imposed by force. And of course, separates Russia, not only from Ukraine, only from Russia, but also from the East in general. The goal of American aggression has been, at least in part, to asset strip the main sectors of the Ukrainian economy, especially those that were linked with the Eurasian markets. The EU, if it were, you know, of course, it's never going to happen. Ukraine's defeat is total. But any kind of European integration would be absurd, not only for Ukraine, but also for the EU. It would cost a fortune to bring Ukraine up to any kind of even minimal EU standards. Already bankrupt countries would have to spend a huge amount of money to bring a fourth world state with no real legal system, with no real functioning capital. They'd have to build it from the ground up. This would be, you know, something for BlackRock to do. But some of their work says that even to start this, you're talking about 60 billion euros. To restore and to modernize Ukrainian economy, to restore sustainable development, 800 billion just to begin. And this is from the EU itself. And I don't think that'll make a dent. Bringing Ukrainian enterprises, if they exist, in line with EU standards, which you could find under the agreement of the association, which very few people read, I think more people should read them. Can't be done in just a few years. And this is from the estimates that come from the Ukrainian League of Industrialists and Entrepreneurs. That's just a handful of Jewish oligarchs. 300 billion over 10 years. And that's a, of course, a laughably low estimate. We've talked about the freezing of Russian assets. But what we haven't spoken of is who owns those assets? A lot of private owners, not necessarily Russian, have assets there. They can't service their obligations toward European banks. Germany has been economically destroyed and is struggling with an invasion. I one time, many years ago, said that I don't believe that anyone will, that you could tell a billionaire working for Mercedes or something where he could make his money. And yes, some of them listened, some of them didn't. And those who didn't were nationalized. The restrictions on Russian energy imports, raw materials, destruction of cooperative ties, freezing joint projects. The EU is harmed more than anyone else. The EU itself says we're talking about €1 trillion just over the last few years. If NATO is ever somehow tricked into any direct war with the world's premier military, which is Russia, that will create a total dependency of the EU on the US. The US could then remake the EU free trade zone into whatever they want. On the positive side, of course, those left by European companies forced out in the Russian market are filled with domestic and sometimes Chinese or Indian products. This has damaged Europe to a tremendous extent as well. I've been talking about the military budget. Now, one of the books I'm working on, which should be, it's actually, it's finished in... I just have to go through and make sure the citations are all proper and the bibliography together is my critique of the U.S. military life and its condition. If you're a Patreon supporter, you may have read some of these. These have been completely rewritten for this book with so much new information. Talk about a broken system. The defense budget has been well over $1 trillion for years now. It's just that if you know where to look in the budget, it's not just what's under defense. It's under many other areas spread around. The same thing for the EU. Not to mention that they've given most of their material to Ukraine to be destroyed immediately. To create a dependent EU. If that's the goal, it has slowly begun to work. In other words, it will then expand the space for American corporations to work, to profit, on their own terms. Now, the U.S. by itself doesn't trade much with Russia at all. Its markets are almost totally independent of Russian supplies. Now, it's interesting that Russia's trade, you know, this is all Glazyev speaking, you know, Glazyev has been saying things in Russian and Ukrainian there at the same time I'm saying them here in English. It's really exciting. Russia's trade with the EU fell by 12% after the imposition of economic sanctions, which would be odd, just 12%. Trade with the U.S., on the contrary, grew by 7% in 2014. It doesn't make any sense to me. Now, if you're a Patreon supporter, I have one of my posts, a lengthy article on the legal nature of sanctions, what a sanction is, I've done a lecture on it on this program. I don't know when that was. It was a while ago. I think it was 2018, 2019. You know, the simple aspects of the, you know, transfer of the oil and gas industry through Hunter Biden, using the Polish president, Alexander Kwasniewski. He visited Kiev 27 times as the Maidan took place. Poland was a part of it. I don't know if that was voluntary or not. And something that should terrify anyone of Polish background is that now that Ukraine has been depopulated, is Poland being viewed as the next Ukraine? The mineral deposits, the shale gas in Kharkov and Donetsk, Transcarpathia, that would be transferred to the exclusive disposal of Shell and Chevron if they had won this. It's unfortunate that Yanukovych, because of the bankrupt nature of the Ukrainian society, had to sell off chunks of Ukraine to these corporations. When I mean sell off, I mean these corporations were sovereign. The worst aspect of fracking is that it takes a massive amount of fresh water. These contracts that Shell and Chevron signed gave them full control over the entire watershed of Ukraine, anywhere in the country. Something else that people don't talk about is that Kiev's museums were plundered. These militants orchestrated by the U.S. Embassy. Many icons and sacred items, just like in the Bolshevik Revolution. You know, priceless, were used to finance some of this. Now, Ukrainians never had a gold reserve. They have pieces of paper, just like the U.S. has no gold reserves. They have pieces of paper that say they have gold reserves. All this taken out by American military transport aircraft. The seizure of Ukrainian markets for nuclear fuel, aircraft, equipment. That's important to American corporations, but no such market exists today. So back in 2014, Ukraine extended the contract with Westinghouse. It had been frozen 2 years earlier. Westinghouse was providing the supply of the TVSW fuel for 3 Soviet-designed nuclear power units. For this purpose, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, the rabbi, or at least descended from rabbi, appointed by the Americans, had to fire the chairman of the State Nuclear Regulatory Inspectorate, Ilina Mikolajchuk, who opposed the use of American fuel at Ukrainian nuclear power plants as threatening a major catastrophe. So you go from the most theoretical concepts to the most crude, just simple theft. But we all know Russia is a metaphysical enemy for some reason. The Orthodox Church, the idea of Putin being the precursor to the restoration of the monarchy, this terrifies the regime, this terrifies the Jews, terrifies Satan. It was Barack Obama who said that Russia is a threat to humanity. It's not just a figure of speech. The anti-Russian rhetoric of Ukrainian Jews, and this is one of the few places that Glazyev mentions the Jews, were brought into power by the regime in Kiev. And despite being in dire poverty, rapidly militarized the society. Whatever kind of consolidation of Ukraine that existed, outside of the eastern regions, of course, was based entirely on Russophobia. The ultimate goal of American aggression is and will always be Russia. So these things are the core of Glazyev's thinking. And you don't have to agree with someone all the time. And I change my mind all the time on things to respect them and understand. And given his tremendous influence, there are people who say he possibly would be in the running to be the next Putin. I'm not entirely sure, but it's conceivable. Now, the way that Glazyev defines the regime, he doesn't use that term, but he knows the concept. It's about vertically integrated production, that is, consolidating all steps in the production chain through, you know, these technological transnational organizations. And they are finance and refinance through the emission of fiat money under centralized control. That system, that's demonic to its core, that's irrational, creates bubbles, supported by media manipulation, this is in decline. It could be nothing else. Glazyev sees China as a model to be followed, and I agree with him. He goes into great detail talking about the state ideology of the People's Republic of China. Speaking of which, of course, that's another book that I haven't looked at in a while, but I did look at it the other day. And, you know, despite everything that's gone on in the meantime, it still works. I am also working on that. So I have three books going at the same time. The U.S. military one, Peter the Great, which I've already spoken to you about, but that's pretty much, that's almost ready to go. And, well, it's basically ready to go in terms of content. And that. And the China book. These are massive undertakings by themselves. And these are largely essays that I've been working on for 9,000 years, or so it seems. And he sees the Chinese state. He doesn't say they're national socialists as I do, because, you know, but he comes very close to it. He says they're based on a pragmatic ideology focused on increasing public welfare, simply based on collective enterprises, leaders in economic development. It is national socialist, but the economy is market-based, yet political leadership is exercised by the Communist Party. And private collective enterprises are the leaders in economic development. Some people say that there is only one party in China. There is not. There are several. I can't get into that now. There are a few of them. But parties are viewed more as specialized advisors than actual electoral opponents. Anyway, that's in my China book. But in China, class struggle, and class struggle is a legitimate concept, has been replaced by cooperation between labor collectives and employers, especially through a developed public sector. And it has to be based, of course, on nationalism, the ethnic connection, homogeneity. This is why Hegel and his philosophy of right was always so attractive to me. I have something coming out on him, too. I don't know what I'm going to do with that. No wonder I have a hard problem. The public-private partnerships determine the degree of freedom the private enterprise has. If it doesn't improve the public welfare, then it shouldn't exist. And he doesn't neglect the Russian spiritual tradition. He is an Orthodox man. It is, he sees the Orthodox tradition as an absolute value. But it must be formalized in the state's legal system. I agree with that as well. Moral principles and values enshrined in legal norms will organize society not only by virtue of tradition, but also by the law enforcement system itself. And the left is going to hate it, and they're going to scream and yell. But it is a very, very popular option in Russia. But you can't do any of this without strong ethnic nationalism. The core of Russian nationalism, of course, the church. China, remember, 93-94% of the population is Han. And all of this is brought together in the national context through strategic planning. Subordinate through the mechanisms of the market economy to the task of increasing public welfare. He goes back and forth in terms of what industry is, as do I. You know, the industrial work, I mean, Trump wants to reindustrialize the U.S., rebuild it that way. And yet we all know the nature of industrial work. I completely agree that tech schools need to be supported, that not just a few people should go off to college. There's way too many people in college. But we still judge a country and a society whether or not it is industrialized. And, but in this case, how that industry is run and for what purpose. Then he also says that they should be liberated from the routine processes that go with the deadening of industrial work. Despite the destruction of the scientific and industrial potential back in the 1990s, the Russian cultural matrix contains massive conditions and potential for raising the innovative activity and making a technological leap into a massive wave of economic growth. Remember, China's growth itself, to a great extent, derives from Russian and even Soviet scientific ability. China's military is largely all Soviet-made equipment that they have reproduced in their own way. But you can't talk about, in terms of Russia, you can't talk about Russian culture as this vague concept. The church is the core of Russian culture, first and foremost. But beyond that, in general, he wants to talk about the Russian and also the Ukrainian mind as something that's almost inherently able to see the spiritual over the material, to fight for you know, the eternal quest for truth, collective intellectual work rather than individualism. That is not, I mean, we've all been brought up to believe that all of this is opposed to the so-called modern economy. It's just not true. Now, since he wrote this, Russia has become the fourth largest country on the planet. Its economy is highly diversified. Oil and gas make up about 9% of her, of course, how you define that's another matter, of her GDP. GNP, a different story, but and that's very important to remember. Now, of course, exports have a strong energy component. But in the East, everything is made in Russia. In the East, in Russia, lots of things are made in China. The societies are tightly connected. I've said 1,000 times, what the hell can Ukraine produce that the rest of the EU hasn't already produced? They have exceptionally beautiful women. I guess that's pretty much it. And given what we know now, you know, that certainly figures into it. He has a vision for the future. But we can't, it's already been an hour, we can't talk about it now. Let's make this a two-parter. And I'm doing this because Glazyev, yeah, it is possible. There's an outside chance he would be the president of Russia. And even if he isn't, he certainly remains one of the most influential men in Russia. So studying his work and studying his ideas and everything I've been saying here has been Glazyev. It's just, it dovetails with mine so perfectly that it's a little weird. And especially because he's Ukrainian, growing up in a very, you know, you got Zaporozhye, you can't get more Ukrainian than that. And his influence, not just domestically, but internationally, within the Eurasian context, is tremendous. So I want to thank my friends for listening. I want to thank my donors. There's one in particular, you know who you are, who have helped me through this in a tremendous way. And I want to thank you in the most humble way possible. I want to continue to alter people's consciousness as much as I can, if that's even possible. Yet I'm told that's what I do. I don't know how. But that's not all that different from what Glazyev is trying to do. And he is a major player in not just the president's office, but in the Eurasian Economic Union itself. Thank you, everyone. I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.